From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, the Labor Department said that another 3.2 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, bringing the total since March to more than 33 million. In a moment, we'll hear from the CEO of Levi Strauss about the effect of the pandemic on retail.
But first, President Trump is moving forward with a message that it's time to reopen the economy, even as the number of new coronavirus cases continues to climb. About half of governors are cautiously opening their states for business. Joining us now is Jeffrey Shaman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, and rather than start with the news, let me ask you a question that may be on a lot of people's minds as they see the country start to open up. Is it okay if you have been an excellent social distancer, you haven't even left your house maybe, to go visit your mom this weekend for Mother's Day?
Well, you know, I think that is a question that everybody would like to know the answer to, and it's very hard to give a specific answer. The reason is that the virus is still circulating in many communities. And that means that it's moving around, and no matter how many reported cases you hear in a particular county, you really probably should multiply that by about 30 to 40, and those would be the number of people who are out there who have the virus and are contagious at this particular time. So if you hear in your community that there are 100 cases, let's say, in the city or town or county in which you live, it's really more like 3,000 to 4,000 people are currently contagious with the virus. That's a rough estimate. Yeah, really. Now, if you've been completely sequestered and your mother has too, and you want to go see her, there's probably not a high risk of doing so, but you can't say that there is no risk. And if your mother is somebody who has diabetes or hypertension or heart disease, it might be best not to do it.
But you do see people at this point, especially as states start to open back up, seeing if they can push the boundaries, even if they're doing so in what they feel is a safe way.
Absolutely. I think we're all getting the itch to get out. We all wish we could go back to normal. And there's going to be, you know, not only is there an economic toll associated with the shutdown and shelter in place, but there's a real psychological and emotional toll. And it's not something that we look at as being sustainable. We have to find a way to allow ourselves to emerge out and to have some level of interaction, but we have to figure out what that level of interaction is that is as safe as possible. And that doesn't mean tossing the economy over and putting everybody in their homes and making us stay there for a year. But we really need testing and contact tracing capacity so that we can squeeze out this disease more. And there may be some combination of measures that we have to take, like ultimately, if you can go out and visit your family, you do it with social distancing practices. Maybe everybody wears a mask.
What would you say to our listeners who live in a state where things are opening up? In Texas, you can go to a movie theater right now. You can go to restaurants as long as you stay a certain distance apart and wear a mask. If you live in a state where it is legal now to do that, or it's acceptable to do that, would you say that it's a wise move to participate in that?
You know, I would say that for some states, they're in a much better position to do that than others. Places like Wyoming and Alaska, they have very low incidence of the disease. Texas is not positioned that way right now. And they've had cases that have been increasing over the last few days. And that's potentially problematic. So the issue here is, if you're loosening restrictions and people are coming together in theaters, are you actually giving the virus more opportunities to transmit? Now, if everybody sits 6 feet apart and everybody wears masks and nobody violates those kinds of rules, it might be a relatively safe environment. But there may not be 100% compliance with that, and there may be opportunities for spreading events, even super spreading events.
Professor, how is it possible that after we basically shut the country down for almost 2 months, closed the borders to other countries, very little air travel going on, that we're still seeing so many deaths per day?
It's because we haven't done it quite the way that would work best. We haven't done it in an optimal way. I personally think that if we look at the model of what was done in South Korea, which has had a very effective track record of really throttling the disease within their country while trying to keep their economy open. They've reopened churches. They've started baseball, albeit to empty stadiums. But they've done the best job of threading this needle. They haven't actually shut any businesses along the way of doing that. And what they've done is they've encouraged face mask use, and they've aggressively tested and contact traced. That's a very powerful control measure that we haven't been able to affect in this country. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's really run through us and continues to do so.
That is Jeffrey Shaman, who's a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Professor, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, more economic news today. Neiman Marcus became the first department store to file for bankruptcy during this pandemic. And some say the outbreak will change the landscape of retail forever. What does Chip Berg think? He's CEO of the 167-year-old Levi Strauss Company. And Chip, you've said that over 167 years, your company has survived it all, including the Spanish flu of 1918. So how is this hitting you?
It's having a real epic impact on retail, and I do believe that it is fundamentally going to change the face of retail. There will be fewer stores, I'm confident. Our strategy, though, for the last 7 years has been to shift the business away from the U.S. and away from U.S. wholesale. You know, think Macy's, Kohl's, JCPenney, Sears, all of those kind of wholesale customers. So 8+ years ago when I got here, 60% of our business was in the U.S. and almost 50% was in U.S. wholesale. Today, less than 45% of our total business is in the U.S. and less than 30% of it is in U.S. wholesale. We'll just continue to double down on the things that are working for us. And I'm convinced we're going to come out of this even stronger than when we went in.
Well, and you may have to say that, right? I mean, you have to be the voice of optimism to pull this, you know, company and its investors and, you know, customers behind you. But you know, the data firm Amperity has some pretty bleak figures. They say demand for food and health-related items is strong, but apparel, no. Demand is down 57%. People don't have the income they had. They've lost their jobs. How are you going to get around some of those concerns? Start with the consumer.
We are already experiencing and now have more than a month of experience in China as consumers have kind of come back out from hibernation. We also have an e-commerce business, and I will say that our e-commerce business around the world has been strong through the pandemic. So there's no question in the short term we're going to take a revenue hit because, you know, in the month of April, 75% of our stores globally were closed and most of our wholesale customers were closed. But the brand really resonates with young consumers. And one of the things that we're seeing is young consumers really do want to get back out and start socializing again and start going back to the stores. In fact, we've had some stores in Europe that have done really well on the very first day that they opened. And when consumers do come back, they're going to reach for the brands that they know and that they trust.
What about your workers? You had to furlough 4,000 workers. You've publicly taken a 50% pay cut. Those are your store workers. I'm thinking of your supply chain as well. 99% of your jeans are made in China, Japan, Italy. How do you keep them safe?
We put our people first. Our stores here in the U.S., we closed them before any government authority asked us to close our stores. And we continued to pay those hourly employees for a full month. And when the Government Care Act came into place, that was the point in time when we determined to furlough them. So our hourly employees were kept whole through a combination of unemployment and the CARES Act.
Well, let's talk about the two different kinds of workers. How do you keep workers in stores safe?
Yeah, and again, we're learning a lot from China. Our employees will have PPE. They'll have masks. We'll have hand sanitization. We will have specific procedures for a product that's tried on. If a consumer doesn't buy that product, we will quarantine it for 24 hours. There will be visible cleaning happening in the stores at all times, and we'll be limiting the number of consumers that can come into the stores. We'll offer buy online, pick up in store. If there are lines outside the door, we'll encourage people to order online and we'll bring the product out to them. We're trying to be as safe as possible and as practical as possible without putting our employees in a position of compromising their own health and safety.
And what about the workers, the people around the world? Some of these factories are not great on a good day, and now we're in a pandemic.
Right. So very early in this, we created a $3 million philanthropic fund. $1 million is going to support the communities in areas where we have large supply chain presence around the world. And the economic impact, as tough as it's been here in the U.S., you can imagine how hard it is in places like Bangladesh and other parts of Asia. And then we have an organization, it was actually the first employee-driven nonprofit organization to support other employees and retirees when they hit a financial hardship. We started this almost 40 years ago. We now have a playbook and we're open sourcing it to other companies as they wrestle with the same thing. We wanted that foundation to be well-funded to support our employees and retirees.
That's Chip Berg, CEO of Levi Strauss. Chip, thank you so much. And as we say to everybody trying to make it through this pandemic, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's been nice chatting with you.
Today's unemployment claims paint a picture of an economy devastated by the coronavirus, but they don't give us the most important measure, according to economist Gene Sperling. He was the director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Obama and Clinton, and he says we ought to be focused on what he calls economic dignity. That's the title of his new book, and Gene Sperling joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
Well, first, just explain what you mean by economic dignity.
You know, I being in economic policy for 30 years, just became, I think, disillusioned with how much our focus in economics is on particular metrics, GDP, productivity. And I feel that it took our eye off the ball of what matters most in life. It makes invisible a lot of our economic pain. And so I wanted to define what I thought our North Star, our ultimate aspiration should be. And I realized that to have true economic dignity, you really need to satisfy three pillars. One, all of us have to have a capacity to not only care for our family and loved ones, to not just be able to put food at the table, but to be at the table, at the bedtime story, at the bedside of older loved ones in their final days. And that secondly, all of us need more than just those provisions. We have a desire to have real first and second chances to pursue our purpose and potential. And finally, the understanding that none of a dignity framework works unless you can ensure that people can contribute economically without domination and humiliation. And I think that this has never been more relevant than it is today. You know, this is really our moment of truth on economic dignity.
Well, how do you measure that? How do you measure somebody's economic dignity the way that you would measure GDP or how many jobs are created or, you know, wage growth?
I believe that economic metrics are important. But the reason why having this qualitative aspiration is so important is that I feel that without it, we allow too much economic pain, too many people to be invisible. So I'll give you an example. Right now, the way it normally is in economics is you have to show that a particular problem is actually lowering jobs, lowering wages, lowering labor force participation. So something like sexual harassment or paid family leave only get designated an economic issue if they show up in an economic metric. But from an economic dignity perspective, it makes you ask if tens of millions of people are going to work feeling dominated, humiliated, abused, harassed. That is an economic challenge in and of itself. When you see people being ordered back to reopen the economy without regard for their PPE, whether they have sick leave, whether they're safe, those people feel that they are being denied that sense of dignity. So an economic dignity framework may not give you precision, But as the saying goes, it may help you be more roughly right than precisely wrong.
Well, when you talk about people being ordered back to work, I assume you're talking about what President Trump has just done to order people who work in meatpacking plants to go back to work. But it does go beyond that right now. Those aren't the only workers who
Absolutely.
Are basically being forced to go to work right now because they're considered essential.
You know, in 1968, Martin Luther King had his famous speech at the Memphis sanitation worker strike. And he not only said that all labor has dignity, but he said that the sanitation worker was as essential as the physician. This is the moment where that has become very real. The farm worker, the delivery person, the grocer, the home health worker, the nurse's assistant. These are now people literally saving our lives. And I think the dissonance that we are rightly feeling is that you do not achieve dignity just with the applause, just with the respect. You have to have dignified treatment. So when 50% of nurse orderlies and home health aides don't have a single day of paid sick leave, when they're making between $11 and $14 an hour, when 87% of domestic workers say they need a mask and only 17% have that, we're starting to have to grapple with, why is it that we do not ensure a level of economic dignity for all workers? Why do we look at jobs that are always the most important in our lives, the people taking care of our children, the caregivers taking care of parents who have heart conditions or dementia? Why is it that we do not offer people like that a dignified wage, health care, paid sick leave, more career mobility? And I think the question for this moment of truth is, will we respond with temporary measures or will it make us rethink whether we should ensure, even in a capitalist society, that there is a certain level of economic dignity that goes not just to putting food on the table, but your ability to be there for your loved ones, your ability to pursue your sense of purpose, and that everyone has the capacity to be in a union or has some capacity to organize, bond, and be able to ensure that they are not subject to domination and humiliation.
So let me ask you about a few of the things that come up in this book, Economic Dignity, that really are top of mind right now. First of all, you talk about how during the Obama administration, during the financial crisis, you were very much in favor of and helped to get people to be able to have mortgage forbearance so that they didn't have to pay their mortgage right away if they couldn't afford it. This is a big topic of conversation right now. Do you think that mortgages at this point should be and could be extended out, maybe even a year for some people or longer, so that they don't fall into foreclosure?
To lose your house, to have to move your family out, to risk homelessness, this is among the greatest assaults of dignity. So mortgage forbearance is almost the easiest thing that you can do. I mean, it's just saying that while we're going through this difficult time, you know, I believe you could tack it on. We should make it interest-free, give people a chance to get back on their feet. But we have to do the same for people who are renting.
But isn't that a lot harder to do with renters, though, because you're dealing with individual landlords and getting them to say, okay, fine, I'll let you take a break on your rent this month?
That's why I think you have to look for what are the bold solutions that solve a lot of these separate issues. And I think you see two being put out there. One is what we've seen is an unemployment that gives you 100% of your wages. That will give people their paycheck that allows them to pay their rent. Or there's a large proposal out by people as diverse as Congresswoman Jayapal to Bernie Sanders to Mark Warner that says if a company will take a worker they would have otherwise laid off and pay them their full salary and keep them on health care, will help foot that bill. Those are the big proposals because they solve several problems at once. They make sure you're made whole and that therefore you can make the rent, the car payment, the things that would allow you to sustain a basic level of economic dignity, you know, in an unprecedented economic crisis pandemic like we are living through right now.
K, can gig workers have the kind of economic dignity that you're talking about if they don't have the kind of benefits that somebody with a full-time job has, and if they don't have the sort of sick leave and family leave and subsidized childcare that you've also been talking about?
Well, the answer is no. You know, the issue with gig workers right now is incredibly important. You know, in 2012, when UberX started, there were already 2 million in-home workers, childcare workers, of which 12% had healthcare, 7% had a pension plan. I think it was a good first step that we included gig workers in the unemployment insurance. And I think a big test for our country will be, will we now reconstruct our programs to make sure that regardless of who your employer is or which way you work, that there is a basic level of healthcare, unemployment insurance, paid sick leave that's available to every American. I mean, that is a must if you're going to have a universal guarantee of economic dignity.
Gene Sperling, it's one thing to write this book and even get people to say, yes, that's exactly what I want. But do you think that this country will be able to do the kinds of things you're talking about, especially if we're about to go into either a deep recession or a depression?
Well, this really is a test for us as a country. You know, does this moment where we literally are relying on many of the workers we have ignored and treated the worst, does it create a new revelation or inspiration to be better than we've been? And look, I've been in two White Houses. I know more than anybody that you are constrained by political reality and divided government. But I can't help but believe that this moment is not going to move the country in somewhat of the right direction, that we should be learning the lessons for our long-term economic compact and not just about the temporary measures to get us through this moment.
That is Gene Sperling, who was director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Obama and Clinton. His new book, which is out this week, is called Economic Dignity. Gene Sperling, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Really appreciate you having me.
And of course, as always, we have an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
The Boston metro area has one of the highest infection and COVID-19 death rates of anywhere in the country. But as in other parts, some parts of this area have been hit harder than others. Chelsea borders Boston through tunnels and bridges to the north. It's kind of a mini Queens, the borough at the heart of the outbreak in New York City. And like Queens, Chelsea is home to immigrants. A third of the residents are from Central America. And there's an income level there 30% lower than neighboring Boston. Let's bring in Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino. And Tom, Mr. Manager, we want to say Chelsea is also colorful and vibrant, but it's densely packed. Is that why there is an outbreak there? Why do you think there's been such an outbreak there?
I think it comes down to a few things that aren't necessarily unique to Chelsea, but describe a lot of these older urban cities that are gateways for new immigrants. People live crowded together in apartments to save money. It has a lot of low-wage workers, so they leave those dense, crowded apartments. They go to work on public transportation and crowded buses and trains, and they work in low-wage jobs in crowded locations like grocery stores. So they're crowded at work, crowded going to work, crowded at home.
Right. In other words, they're essential, too. And you mentioned crowded at home. And we're understanding there have been reports that people were getting kicked out of their homes because they'd been infected. And we know that you offered residents the chance to stay at a hotel in nearby Revere, but you've said it was hard to get people to do that. So talk a little more about that problem. People fearful of each other and then maybe fearful of moving. What's going on?
So that was a phenomenon we were seeing early on. People who had COVID-19 positive cases who weren't able to return to their previous living situation, either because their roommates were afraid and wouldn't let them back in, or because they had vulnerable people in a family and it wasn't viable for them to isolate. And so we did create this hotel opportunity in Revere with our neighbor. The problem is it is hard to get people to leave their homes. And there's some fear. You know, this is an immigrant population. Anything that involves the government raises concerns that is this the first step towards a deportation? So we have to overcome a lot of those concerns when we're trying to help people here.
Yeah. Well, Manager Ambrosino, can you just describe what it's like there now, how high the levels are, and what you're trying to do as a city?
So the levels are extraordinarily high. About 5% of our population has tested positive, and those are confirmed tests. So we know the actual rates of infection are much, much higher. We clearly have the highest rates of infection in the Commonwealth. We're trying to provide as much support for people as we can. I mean, the economic impacts here have been devastating. Lots of people with no income at all and no prospects of getting government assistance because they work underground or they are undocumented immigrants. So we have a massive food distribution effort ongoing to feed about 18,000 of our 40,000 residents. We have a rental assistance program, so we have lots of efforts to help people, but the needs here are overwhelming and greater than what a small city government can meet. But the numbers the last week have started to go down, so we do feel like we're on the other side of the curve, and at least on the health side, the things look promising. The long-term impacts are economically, and that will take a long time to heal.
That's Chelsea City Manager Tom Ambrosino. Manager Ambrosino, we wish you all the best with it. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Demand for hand sanitizer has skyrocketed ever since the coronavirus outbreak began. Alcohol is a primary ingredient, so distilleries across the country are switching gears and trying to help meet the demand. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports.
The Hotel Tango Distillery near downtown Indianapolis usually is focused on producing bourbon, rye, and other liquor. But when the coronavirus hit, CEO Travis Barnes saw a very different need that his company could fill. Hand sanitizer.
Well, I was actually reading about people making it incorrectly and that they weren't actually making anything that could actually kill germs. So we have the facility, we have the ingredients on hand to really produce that. So we kind of just shifted gears to produce actual hand cleaner.
Barnes turned production and tasting room space into an assembly line. Workers switched to making thousands of bottles of sanitizer, putting labels on 4-ounce containers, and taping boxes for shipment.
I think it's a needed product right now to keep people healthy, and I'm proud and humbled that our company is able to provide that for everybody else out there.
After getting federal approval, dozens of microbreweries and small distilleries across the country are helping out. So are giants like Anheuser-Busch. Dean Eric Barker, Purdue's College of Pharmacy, says to make effective hand sanitizer, it must be at least 60% ethanol and include hydrogen peroxide and glycerol. The final product might be unfamiliar to consumers.
The consistency of the FDA-approved products is going to be different than what you might find in the traditional over-the-counter products like Purell. It's going to be a much thinner consistency.
Indianapolis's Hotel Tango has received requests for sanitizer from all around the country. Once federal approval was in hand, the first batch of about 4,000 bottles headed out for delivery, for free. One box went to the Padded Shoe Foundation, an Indianapolis organization that provides thousands of meals to school children. Executive Director Matthew Feltrop says the supply will help keep team members safe while delivering meals.
Now we have a case from Hotel Tango that we'll be able to use probably for the next month.
Since the first batch was delivered, the distillery has also started selling the hand sanitizer. With so much demand for sanitizer, Hotel Tango has avoided the layoffs hitting other companies. After a run on commercial sanitizer, some people started making their own at home. Purdue's Eric Barker says FDA-approved businesses like distilleries and pharmacies bring a guarantee of effectiveness.
Giving guidance to those that have the core knowledge around percent alcohol, particularly, and compounding, so we can get the safe and effective products into the hands of consumers is a priority.
But Barker adds one note of caution. While sanitizer does help, He says washing with soap for 20 seconds is still the most effective measure to prevent the spread of the virus. For Here and Now, I'm Samantha Horton in Indianapolis.
Well, that is something completely different. Paleontologists working in the Moroccan Sahara have unearthed fossils that provide evidence for the first known dinosaur with an aquatic lifestyle. Scientists now think Spinosaurus aegyptiacus grew up to 50 feet long, sported a large sail on its back, and cruised an ancient river system about 100 million years ago. That's based on the newly discovered fossils of its giant paddle-like tail. The findings were published in the journal Nature, and we're joined now by the lead paleontologist who made the discovery, Nizar Ibrahim, a National Geographic explorer and an assistant professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. His work was funded by the National Geographic Society. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'll start by describing the fossils you found. What do they look like?
They're absolutely amazing. So the key piece we found was a nearly complete tail of Spinosaurus. And it's utterly bizarre. It looks like a giant fin-like structure, something unique in the world of dinosaurs. And so we think that this fin-like propulsive organ was basically moving this animal through ancient rivers.
Just the fin? Because I think about, you know, penguins that have wings, but they don't really fly. How do we know that just because it had a fin that it was able to move through the water?
Well, I mean, there are a number of clues in the skeleton that tell us that this was a water-loving dinosaur. It has a long, narrow snout like a crocodile with conical teeth, perfect to catch slippery prey like fish. It has dense bone for buoyancy control, relatively small hind limbs. But the tail really is the most important part because it's absolutely huge and it really does look like a giant paddle.
So based on what you have seen, paint a picture for us. As far as you can tell now, what did Spinosaurus look like and how did it live?
Well, the really cool thing about Spinosaurus is that there's no real modern-day equivalent, right? It's like working on an extraterrestrial from outer space. And so this was a giant predator, crocodile-like, narrow jaws, a huge sail on its back, a paddle-like tail. It would have looked like some kind of river monster out of a dragon story, a really bizarre creature. And it would have been hunting aquatic creatures in a massive river system that existed in the place we now call the Sahara Desert. Let me just kind of paint that part of the picture for you. So those fish we're talking about are absolutely enormous. Coelacanths the size of cars, 25-foot-long sawfish, giant lungfish. So really abundant prey for a giant aquatic predator like Spinosaurus.
And we know that there were fish and large aquatic reptiles during this time of the dinosaurs, but this would be the first true dinosaur that was aquatic, right?
Yes. So for a very long time, scientists have essentially established this dogma that essentially says that dinosaurs just did not invade aquatic habitats, right? They're land-dwelling animals. We know that some of them took to the air. Birds are direct descendants of dinosaurs. Indeed, they are dinosaurs. But we thought that they never really invaded the watery world. So this is the first example of a dinosaur doing just that. So that really opens a whole new window of ecological opportunities for dinosaurs.
How did you discover it?
Well, it was a pretty incredible adventure story. We've been working on this dig site for a number of years, but most of my team members thought that we were kind of done with this dig site. We had uncovered whatever was there to be uncovered. But I always had a hunch that maybe the largest part of the skeleton was actually still buried under the rocks. The problem was that the area we had to clear was basically consisted of about 15 tons of rock. So removing 15 tons of rock on a steep escarpment in the Sahara Desert in 120 degrees Fahrenheit is not easy. And everything that could possibly go wrong did go wrong. We had sandstorms and close encounters with snakes and flooding in the Sahara. You name it, we experienced it. But it was worth it. When we finally got to the bone-bearing layer, we hit the jackpot. And it was just one bone after another. And that's really when it became clear that we had made a discovery that is really going to change the way we look at dinosaurs. When we're piecing together these tail bones, we realized that this was something utterly unique. In many ways, it's comparable to the tail of, for example, a crocodile.
Is it possible that the crocodile is related in some way to this Spinosaurus?
Well, crocodiles are related to dinosaurs, but they're only distantly related in the grand scheme of things. And so what we see similarities between crocodiles and Spinosaurus, for example, in terms of the tooth anatomy or the tail shape, these are really just examples of what we call convergent evolution. So, you know, they lived in a similar kind of environment. And if you want to move around the water, you'll evolve a similar kind of tail shape, for example. So this is the same reason why, you know, dolphins and sharks have a roughly comparable kind of torpedo-shaped body. So this is really just convergence. They're not really closely related.
Do you think that Spinosaurus are unique, or could there be other aquatic dinosaurs waiting to be discovered?
Well, I think after this study, people in museums all around the world will go back to their paleontological collections and look at some of their fossils and see if maybe there are some other previously overlooked aquatic dinosaurs out there. We now, you know, presented evidence for aquatic habits in this dinosaur, and so people can look at other fossils in their collections and see if maybe some fossils match the ones we see in Spinosaurus. You know, things like very dense bone for buoyancy control or very long spines on the tail. So who knows? But for now, Spinosaurus is the only dinosaur that shows unambiguous evidence for essentially a fully aquatic lifestyle.
Well, I could say that they could now make a Jurassic Park movie all about this, but they already did and had an aquatic dinosaur in one of them. But I don't think it did very well, that one. Anyway, that is Nizar Ibrahim, who is a National Geographic explorer and assistant professor of biology at the University of Detroit Mercy. Nizar, thank you.
Sure. You're very welcome.
And we've got pictures of the Spinosaurus at hereandnow.org.
Well, some of the world is rolling along despite the pandemic. For instance, the U.S. women's soccer team continues its gender discrimination fight despite a recent setback. Last week, a federal judge threw out the players' claim that they aren't paid as much as the men's national team. That was $66 million in damages at stake there. The women plan to appeal. Mike Pesca, Here Now's sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, is here. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So this U.S. District Court judge in California issued a ruling against the women's team last Friday. He left in place other discrimination claims about, you know, how the women are treated differently than men when it comes to travel and hotel. But what did he say about pay?
Yes, I'd say it's more than a setback. It was a summary judgment, and it went to the heart of the case. And what a summary judgment means is that the judge looks at it and says that there is no chance a reasonable jury or reasonable adjudicator just on the facts would be able to find for one of the litigants. And so what he found was this is a gender discrimination suit based on pay. He looked at the pay and he said, well, you were paid more, the U.S. women were. The U.S. women were paid more than the men during the period of their lawsuit. There are a lot of asterisks to that, and the judge and the women presented those, and the judge looked at them, but he didn't buy them. One big asterisk is that this was settled, this was determined, their pay was determined and collectively bargained for. So the women were arguing, well, we only, you know, we're kind of restricted in what the our bargaining partners, if you will, the U.S. National Soccer Federation would give. But the judge didn't buy it. The judge said you had a chance to opt for the guaranteed of contracts, which maybe wouldn't have the upside, or you had a chance to bargain for the men's type contract, which would pay you a lot if you won. You chose the guarantees and you made more money. So based on that, you can't have a gender discrimination lawsuit. And that is, there were those 60 some odd million in damages that was probably inflated, but even a reasonable amount of damages that the women would have been said to endure, that's been thrown out. It's appealable, but it could take a long time. And it's not likely that just based on the judge's record, most of his rulings stick.
Well, but Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan said this week that they will appeal. So the assumption was, and you know, we know what we say about when you spell the word assume, the assumption was that you know, they've got such a force behind them. We remember the crowd yelling, pay them more, you know, that they were going to win out in the end. You're saying it's not appealable, or it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, I think in case law, I don't know how many it is appealable. It's just the appeal process will take a very long time. And it is, you know, the legal experts that I've looked at say they don't know how likely that the appeal will work. And even if the appeal goes through, it doesn't mean they'll win. It just means that the summary judgment might be reversed, which is a long way of saying what you just pointed to, the crowd chanting. Yes, in a court of law, they will never cite precedents like the Heller decision or a crowd chanting. Those that will not be cited. But because the public is so on their side, it's an impetus for both sides in this dispute to sit down at the table and say, let us not have more acrimony that hurts the sport. Let's get you paid in a more fair way. That is true.
The other discrimination claims about travel accommodations, that's going to go to a jury trial. The judge let that stand. So those claims will go to a jury trial I think in June. So there's that. Okay, so we're going to keep an eye on that. By the way, former Vice President Joe Biden, of course, the presumptive Democratic presidential candidate, has threatened to strip funding from the U.S. Soccer Federation for the 2026 World Cup if he's elected, unless the women get equal pay. Does that threat make any difference?
I don't think it does. And we're in a time of norm violations, but this is... If he becomes president, someone saying, what, I've looked at a judge's case and decided that he decided it wrong. I mean, I guess charitably you could say that he's just trying to stand for the general principle of equal pay. And the Soccer Federation themselves say, we're not against equal pay. In fact, we won our lawsuit because we've been giving equal pay. But yes, there'll be a chance to negotiate a better, more fair settlement that's more acceptable to the female players, the women players. And I guess Joe Biden was weighing in on the side of that in general.
Okay, I want to talk about baseball real quick. Have you seen these pictures out of South Korea? They've started playing, and they made life-size, life-ish cutouts of men and women, human beings, for every seat in a stadium, for the guy selling hot dogs. If you squint your eyes, it looks real. It's also really creepy. We'll have a picture at herenow.org. But what's the plan for the U.S. Major League Baseball season?
Well, you know, a month maybe, they say. We could start with our facilities. The major league owners have just floated a proposal to the players, some of their more grandiose proposals about quarantining and testing. It's very hard for that to get going because, you know, if any one person fails a test on a team, what does that mean? The entire season shuts down. I understand, and football is up against this too. I understand that in baseball, The season is supposed to be well underway. And it's good to have a plan, but you can't have a plan that outsmarts a virus or gets in front of a virus when you don't know what the course of the virus is going to be.
Well, we got to leave it at that. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst, the host of the daily podcast, The Gist. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.